Our guest today, Tom Utes, prolific songwriter, singer, amazing guitar player. Sometimes we forget to mention that. Tom has released a new album, To Live in Two Worlds, Volume 2. We're going to talk to Tom at length about that album. Tom has been a guest on Unreal Bluegrass several times over the years. It's always enjoyable, always enlightening. We're going to start this portion of the show off with a single from that new album, To Live in Two Worlds, Volume 2, In This House. And then we're going to begin our visit with Tom Utes. You're going to enjoy it.
Well, we just heard Milltown Blues from my guest today on Unreal Bluegrass, a frequent contributor. Milltown Blues is from his newest album, To Live in Two Worlds. So happy to welcome back to Unreal Bluegrass, Tom Utes.
Hey, how you doing, man? Thank you for having me.
Doing good. I'm always thrilled. Tom, you've been on the program several times. I think the first time you and I really encountered each other is Mac Wiseman had recorded. You'd written a lot of songs, and the last album that he did in the studio. You were there to help me communicate with Mac about that album. You wrote a lot of songs, as did I think Peter Cooper's on there a lot, and that was very helpful to me to get to talk to an absolute legend like Mac Wiseman. Was wonderful, and then from then on we've met and talked about your own music.
Yeah, I mean, I still remember that afternoon when I went over to Mac's house and we had that conversation. It was funny because Mac's hearing was not good anymore, and his hearing aids were pretty old, and for some reason he didn't want to get new ones. So being on there, doing a phone interview on the radio, was a little stressful sometimes with him because I had to sort of yell the questions.
Well, I gathered that's why you were there, not just because of your work on the record, but I knew you were there to help me communicate with him, which I appreciate greatly. Wonderful. I had a wonderful time talking to Mac. That was a great time.
Oh, man, Mac was so good. He was such a good friend, and I certainly miss him and his girlfriend, partner, / caretaker, just recently gave Peter and me each one of Mac's belts that were like custom made, Western belts. So that's in my studio where I can always see it. And Mac was a wonderful friend.
And you brought him back to the legends. Rhonda Vincent did a show. Did you help Mac come back to the Ryman for that recording also?
Well, I was there. Yes, he asked me to come and play with the band, and certainly they didn't need my help as a guitar player, but I think it just made him feel better knowing that I was there, and I could. So that was a great thrill because he sang together with Bobby Osborne on that, and that was wonderful too.
There were a lot of firsts, and I've told Rhonda nobody could have pulled it off but her.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Well, listen. So you are very familiar to me. I maybe want the audience to let's catch up a little bit. The liner notes from Peter Cooper make reference to the fact of your European heritage, I guess, and then that people would not know it because Tom Utes does research in historical matters that are particular to Civil War American culture. But this time around, let's give them a little bit of a background of you, get you back to America really quickly, then we'll get into this brand new album. To Live in Two Worlds. Okay.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was born in the Black Forest of Germany, which is the very southwestern tip of Germany. And when I was about 8, 9 years old, I started listening to American Forces Network, just through a coincidence, and discovered country music, which I didn't know at the time that it was country music, but the sound of it was intriguing to me and soothing, and so I started listening to country music. And then when I was 11, I heard saw Bobby Bear on a German country music television show, and it just completely blew me away, and I started playing guitar pretty much that day, and did everything I could to learn about Nashville and that music and about bluegrass music and about, Southern culture and all of that. I don't know. It's just one thing led to another, and I knew I was going to want to move to Nashville at some point. And when I was in my very early 30s, I, after a couple of years, won a green card in the diversity lottery. And my wife and I moved to Nashville, which is 20 years ago now, and never looked back, and was very lucky and very fortunate to fall in with some really good people and, write songs and get songs recorded and make records and play for other people, produce records for other people. So it's really a dream come true, and I'm aware of that every day that I spend here, and I'm profoundly grateful for it.
You, Tom, you wrote songs, and you kind of run through it quickly, but you wrote a lot of songs that were recorded by a lot of established performers in Nashville, and you even toured did you not, or perform on stage with some of them also? As I recall, this is from a discussion we had in person years ago.
Yeah. So when I moved here, I moved here as mainly as a guitar player, and I toured for a couple of years with a great songwriter called David Olney, who just recently passed away,
and I toured with
a great songwriter called Mary Gaucher, and then I played with Nancy Griffith for 5 years, and then I started concentrating more on producing stuff, and so that's how I got to work with Mag Wiseman and with Whispering Bill Anderson and people like that. And then I was also fortunate enough to have a lot of bluegrass people record my songs, and it's always a wonderful thing when people do that and you hear your the thing that you wrote in your bedroom coming back and somebody really cool is singing it and playing it. So it's, like I said, it's a weird story. It's almost like a little too good to be true sometimes, but it's what feels like it. But it's like, it's also, it's sort of a testament to if you have a vision and a dream and whatever, you just stick with it and put in the work and hopefully have a good work ethic, something will come of it.
You're a great guitar player. You're such a prolific songwriter. Well, I'll tell the audience this too. There's not a program that doesn't go by. Every program of Unreal Bluegrass starts off with a theme song, which is entitled Pick Piece, and I usually tell them throughout the program that it's the result of your efforts and Mylon Miller. It's a great little tune. It fits exactly to the theme of what I've always had for this program, and I think you and I have talked about that also. But it's a great tune. I'm forever indebted to you and Mylon for putting that together.
It's a wonderful
intro to the program. It's exactly what this show's about.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, I don't know that it took us longer than 10 minutes to write it and 20 minutes to record it or something. So it was just something that fell out, and we wanted to say that too. We wanted to express that. And every time you post that on your Facebook thing, I always respond with, "It's always an option."
It's always an option. That's how I end the show. Why not? Well, and the reason I bring it up is also to express to you every time I see you the gratitude for doing that. But also, you are such a prolific writer, and this comes in mind with the Mac Wiseman thing too. That I remember talking to you about that. In addition to talking to Mac about it, is you would go visit with Mac, and you wrote songs. Other people did too and contributed. You wrote songs about segments of his life, and it was like every week you wrote a couple more. And I can't. It's just like even when you say, "Oh, we got together to do the theme for Unreal Bluegrass." You are a prolific songster. You write songs. And on this new album that we're going to talk about, "To Live in Two Worlds," Volume 1, and there's a Volume 2. There are a lot of songs. Mm-hmm. They're all different. You write great songs, and you're prolific at doing that. That's just my comment. And I'm always amazed at the volume you can put out that is so quality.
Well, thank you. But, I mean, it's a lot of fun to write songs. So it's not like it's hard work. It's not like digging a hole somewhere. It's fun. And it's fun for me to research. Not research is too big a word. It's just fun for me to hear and learn and read about things that people used to do, ways of living from older days. And like I said, I'm really into Southern culture, really into Western North, really interested in Western North Carolina at the moment and that history. And it's just fun. It doesn't feel like work. You have to sort of know what you're doing, I guess, but I've been doing it for a long time. So it doesn't feel necessarily difficult to me. I mean, I know that there's a craft to it, and it certainly doesn't always come easy, but it's like, what else would I do is the other thing. I can't do anything else. The only thing I'm qualified for is play guitar, engineer a little bit, and write songs. So I might as well do that.
I'll go with that explanation. If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to a frequent contributor to Unreal Bluegrass and wonderful talent, Tom Utes. Tom, this project that you've just released is interesting, not only just for the music, but there's it's a two-part release. Can you talk about that? And also the label that it's on, so people know where to find it.
Yeah. So these two records are out on Mountain Home Music out of Asheville, North Carolina. The owner, Mickey Gamble, and I, we kind of became good friends 2 years ago, and they asked me to join their team as a writer because they also have a publishing company, and and I was happy to do that. So they're, whatever I write, I play it for them, and they pitch it to other people, and hopefully somebody records it. And then a couple months after that, Mickey called me and said, "Hey, it's good that you're writing these songs for us, but why don't you make a couple of records for us?" So I said, "Well, sure, that'd be great." They got two really good studios up there in the complex where the company is, and so I made those records there, which is a new thing for me because most of the records that I've put out under my own name were recorded at my studio. So I was really happy to go somewhere else and be in a different environment and bring my favorite players with me there. And so that's one thing that I'd like to say about this new record. So these two new records, the band is really just, it's incredible to think that I could get these people all in the studio to help me do this in for 2 days. It's Tammy Rogers, who's a wonderful fiddle player, who's in the Steel Drivers, and she's also one of my most frequent co-writers these days. So on those two records, there's 8 songs that we wrote together, and she sings on it too. And like I said, she's in the Steel Drivers. Then Mike Ponton is playing mandolin, who's my favorite mandolin player in that style. I'm not saying there's a lot of other wonderful mandolin players, but Mike is so steeped in the tradition of Southern music.
Oh, yeah. He knows the chapter and verse and what valley and over the hill this happened. And, he's definitely into it. It's a lot like you are as far as the research you do into history. Mike Compton is just a remarkable.
He's a legend, and I just love the way he plays. And I really wanted him to be on this record, and I was lucky that it worked out. And then my friend Mark Fain, who's a wonderful bass player, I don't even really want to play when he's not there. He's played on everything that I put out over the last 15 years, is on bass. And then Justin Moses plays banjo and dobro, who is a great player and also has been on the Mac record and all of the other stuff
right,
I've done
right.
over the last couple of years.
Right.
And then the other thing probably to talk about is when Mickey Gamble asked me to record for Mountain Home, I said, "Well, look, man, I had this idea to make a record with just me singing and playing at the same time into one microphone, into an old ribbon style, an old style ribbon microphone, because I just love the sound of those old records." And he said, that's fine. Do a band record and do one of the solo, do that solo thing," which not a lot of people would have said that because the solo thing is really, you know, it's not bluegrass, it's not folk, it's somewhere in between. And it's really more of a documentation of what I do as a songwriter. But Mickey is a very open-minded person, and he encouraged me to do this. So we ended up with a band record with 14 songs and then a solo record with 14 songs. And we looked at it and went like, wouldn't it be interesting to combine those? And I kind of ran with that idea for a while, and that would actually work well. You know, that way it's not just one band record and one solo record, but it's like spread out over two records. And then when we started thinking about that and started looking at the songs, we realized that the songs actually worked in pairs, worked really well in pairs. So every band song on this record and on the next one, too, is followed by a solo song, and then it's another band song and a solo song, and they all correspond with each other thematically. So it's, for instance, the first song is Milltown Blues, which is about Charlie Poole, who's one of my favorite musicians ever, Charlie Poole and the North Carolina Ramblers, that recorded and wrote White House Blues and stuff like that.
Oh, legend.
Sing Today or Don't Let Your Deal Go Down. And then, so that's a real up-tempo, fast bluegrass song, as your audience has just heard. And then the following piece is like a slow, bluesy kind of thing that's about Skip James and about Blind Willie McTell and also about Charlie Poole. So it's about my heroes in roots music and how I wish I could have heard them back in the day. I always say I would have loved to live in the 20s, only with antibiotics. And so it's about that desire. It's about the desire to. It's about the joy that that old music brings me, and the fascination with those characters, and you know, they're really American heroes and heroes of American music. You know, Blind Willie McTell played on the street corners in Atlanta and could find his way through town because he could identify the sound of the streetcars. And wrote just incredible stuff.
On the first volume, Tom, when you mentioned Blind Willie McTell, you have a tune I don't know if there's really is a blind Alfred Reed, or if it's kind of based on a conglomeration or of artists that you knew, and you tell the story of blind Alfred Reed, which is on the first volume also, and she can maybe explain that a little bit.
Yeah, blind Alfred Reed was a blind preacher and street musician who from West Virginia, and he was part of the Bristol Sessions in 1927. And so that's another thing that blew my mind, that there's also a song about Jimmy Rogers on the record.
Right.
And if you think about it, Jimmy Rogers came to the Bristol Sessions in 1927 he was originally from Meridian, Mississippi, and found his way to the Bristol Sessions that way. And Blind Willie McTell had heard about the Sessions, and he found his way there from West Virginia, and they recorded on what arguably is the most important recording session in American music.
I think, Tom, people are starting to realize how important that session was. I think, for whatever reason, it's always been second to something else, but I think that it's becoming more and more obvious that the Bristol Sessions were a unique and special event.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. I mean, it pretty much all started there, and it just blows my mind, you know, that a man like Blind Alfred Reed, he had children, and he would just, every day, he would walk 3 miles to the closest town where he lived, and he would play on the street corner every day, and when he had a good day, he could buy a pound of bacon or something and carry it home, you know. And to me, that's worth writing about. You know, I don't always have to write about lofty ideals. I'd rather write about a blind man who plays music for a living and gets paid with a pound of bacon.
Tom Utes, I want to cut to a tune from that first volume, but I also don't want to miss the opportunity to talk about Tammy Rogers, who you mentioned early on. Tammy Rogers and the Steel Drivers, who I'm a fan of, they've gone through a lot of changes. Two of the things that I know for a fact that remain, Richard Bailey, I'm crazy about his banjo styling, and I also think that Tammy's fiddle and her singing, there's interchangeable parts maybe as they find new people to come in and sing the lead after Chris Stapleton left. But Tammy is Tammy's the sound that, to me, that makes that recognizable as the Steel Driver. Her fiddle playing is so good, and she just fits in so well with those type of tunes. I've always been absolutely enamored with her playing and her singing, and I'm glad to have you mention her, and I'm glad you're writing with her too. And she also, you do a lot of co-writes, and those people can join with you on some of these songs as I look through this, right?
Yeah. So, like I said, Tammy and I have been writing a lot together since about 2.5 years or so. And The Steel Drivers recorded two songs that are songs on the new record that's just about to come out here in a couple of weeks.
Yeah,
and she's just one of my best friends, and we just like to hang out together. And yeah, I agree with you. I mean, the sound of her voice just connects all the dots in
absolutely.
That band, I think. And her playing is brilliant, and she's also a great classical violin player.
She's
incredibly musical person.
I have an album of duets with her and Richard, and I am. Richard Bailey, me, is as good a banjo player, and I have that album. Richard gave it to me once because I wanted it. And every once in a while I play a cut from that. But let's do from then Volume 1. Let's cut to another song from Volume 1 as we're discussing this, To Live in Two Worlds with Tom Utes. And I think we're going to cut to Hartford Bend.
Yes. So this is Hartford's Bend. It's a song about John Hartford, and he's a big inspiration to me and a lot of friends of mine. And I read one day that when he built his house in Nashville on the Cumberland River, he had a little like almost a little tower or something on top of the house where he could look down on the Cumberland River. The house is right on the Cumberland River, and because he was obviously obsessed with the history of the Mississippi River and the Missouri River, and he was a steamboat captain, actually, too. He had a license as a steamboat captain. So he would always sit up there, and he would look down on the Cumberland River and watch those big barges go by, and he would communicate with the pilots of those boats on CB radio. And after he had passed away, that bend in the river where the house is was, I think it's mile marker 207 or something like that, was named Hartford's Bend in his honor. And the captains of those boats knew, obviously, they were communicating with him, and they would always blow their whistle when they came out that bend. Mm. And that's just a story I read somewhere, and I thought, like, man, I would love to write that, to turn that into a song. But I didn't know Hartford. He passed away 2 years before I moved to town. And so I happen to be good friends with a guy called John Hadley that I wrote the song with. And Hadley used to work with John Hartford on the Smothers Brothers show in the late 60s in California. So I asked Hadley if he wanted to write that song with me, and he was happy to do that. He's a wonderful songwriter. And his house is in Madison, Tennessee also, which is just like 2 miles down the road from where John Hartford lived. And Hadley keeps a wonderful sepia-toned portrait of John Hartford in his writing room, and also a chair from John's estate that has John Hartford's chair kind of scraped in it with a penknife. John Hadley bought that at a yard sale, and then he took it home, and with his penknife he scratched John Hartford's chair into it. So I was looking at that chair and at a big portrait of John Hartford while we wrote the song called Hartford's Bend.
Well, with that great introduction, let's play Hartford's Bend. I'm talking to Tom Utes, and we're going to hear Hartford's Bend from To Live in Two Worlds. This is off of the Volume 1 CD. We'll hear that, and we'll be right back to talk to Tom Utes again right here on Unreal Bluegrass. Well, there you got to hear Hartford's Bend from Tom Utes. Tom, you talked about John, the inspiration to you. I think, don't you think that people are going to keep getting relearning and getting re-inspired by John? I mean, everybody knew he wrote, I don't know, one of the most famous songs ever, Gentle on My Mind, been recorded by so many people. But I think they are beginning again to rediscover all of the talent in the fiddle playing and all the music that he wrote and all the culture and all the information that he brought. It seems to me that people are going to keep rediscovering that. You did, because you arrived in town 2 years after he was passed. But I think there's a wealth of material that's coming up. Somebody just published a book of his fiddle tunes within the last year or so.
Yes. The collection of fiddle tunes that just came out about a year ago is absolutely incredible. John wrote all those tunes on little 4x10, I think, cards, or 4x6 cards, and he's in the most beautiful writing and notation. And the book is basically, there's thousands of those cards. And his daughter worked together with a guy called Greg Reese and then a wonderful fiddle player called Matt Combs, and they put that together in that book with great photos. And it's a wonderful, wonderful book. And they're also working on a recording of a compilation of all those fiddle tunes. To answer your question, I think people are going to always rediscover John Hartford, because not just because of Gentle on My Mind, and not just because he was a brilliant fiddle player and a brilliant banjo player, but also because he had such a lighthearted approach to music. There was humor in his music. By that, I'm not saying that he was trying to be funny.
No,
but it was lighthearted, and it was the dancing and the approach to the songwriting. I mean, if you just listen to Steam Powered Aeroplane, you know, the way it starts and all that. It was completely unique. I can't think of anybody else who was like that. And I can't think of anybody else today who's like that. I think Tim O'Brien is. Yeah, sorry.
No, you're right, Tim O'Brien. Go ahead. That's a great connection. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think when I think of who does things sort of a little bit like Hartford did, and by that I'm not saying he's copying or stealing or anything, not at all. I think Tim O'Brien comes to mind. He's got that. That lightness to him in his writing and his singing and his playing.
It's the ease that he seems to, and you see him perform, he's not the most relaxed guy, and he's always got a smile, and the things just kind of flow through, and you think, well, was he really performing? Because he's so easy and has a great smile. You can almost hear the smile in his singing, and of course, brilliant singer, but that's a great analogy, Tim O'Brien. I think you hit that right on the head. Let's talk a little bit about then, you mentioned earlier that there are solos and there are band, full band songs. Are both versions of The Flood of 2010, are they both on the second? As I have both. Go ahead.
Yeah, those are both on the second volume. I don't know how that happened, why we decided to do that. I think I just, when I recorded the solo stuff, I ended up with a version that I really, really liked. But I also think it's a song that would be fitting for, or is going to be fitting for radio when the 10th anniversary of The Flood comes around, which will be May 1st in 2020. And so we decided to, well, let's record it with a band too, because not every radio station could play that really stripped down solo thing. And But I also wanted to have the, I like having the solo version involved because it sounds like an old folk song to me, and the approach is such that, or the approach is like, it may have been like, you know, 150 years ago people wrote songs about floods and accidents and train wrecks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore because we have radio and TV and all that. And so I just thought, like, man, it might be a good idea to write a song about the flood of 2010, because I remember vividly, and I was on the road at the time and out in California and stuck at an airport hotel because we couldn't fly into Nashville, and I was nervous as hell because we were like 2 miles from the Percy Creek Lake, which is a man-made lake, and the dam of the Stones River is like maybe 5 miles from our house, and I didn't know whether our house was going to make it or not. And it was an amazing thing. The Cumberland River rose 40 feet, came all the way up to Lower Broadway, stopped right at Groom Guitars' door, basically, and it was amazing. So I just wanted to write about it.
I'll tell you an odd story. I used to play with some, we used to get around and play music different places, and it's not like I was there very often, but we happened to play in Nashville right across, in a hotel right across the road from the Opry Mills, and that the night before. And we did a thing there for a military group that hired us to come down and play music. And so then we get back in our car and we go home. So as we're getting home, you get home and it's like we were like, I don't know, a few raindrops ahead of the flood, because it covered all of that area. And then I, of course, I was a rare thing for me to play music in Nashville, believe me, but all of the friends that I know from there, they couldn't get to their houses for a long, long time. And then there was instrument damage, and there was some instrument damage at some guitar places. And you can just imagine and I also think that were it not for social media with friends I have, I wouldn't have known how devastating it was because the media wasn't really covering it.
Right. I think it's the flood of 2010, and for anybody in Nashville or around Nashville, will be one of those things where you'll always remember where you were when it happened, because it was unbelievable. I mean, the west side of town, there were whole neighborhoods were destroyed. It looked like a nuclear bomb had hit or something after people had cleaned out their houses and knocked out all the drywall. And people from all over town would just show up and help. That was the most amazing thing, that, you know, people would just go to the west of town with a pair of gloves and a shovel and start knocking out drywall in people's houses that they didn't know who those people were. And it wasn't just like a couple of people. It was hundreds of people who just showed up to help. And that was another thing that I wanted to put in this song, because when I get frustrated today about how divided our society is, sometimes I think about that. And it makes me, you know, it reminds me of the fact that we can still do that. You know, we can still get out there and help each other, and we will always have that capacity if we're willing to do that.
And I think on an individual basis, we're all still decent people. And something about being separated, and this is my editorial, it's not needed at all, Tom, but I think I know what you're saying, is that, you know, if your neighbor is your neighbor, it doesn't really matter how they may agree or disagree with headlines with you. But when something like that happens, you're all still the same people deep down inside, and it's nice that that can still be brought up in a horrible way. But it's nice that you can look back and think, yeah, that's what people in this country and probably in the world are really, really about, is those events.
I totally agree with you. I think fundamentally we're all decent people, and there are ways for us to get along. And I also agree with what you said. Your neighbor is your neighbor. It doesn't matter what he believes in or who he votes for or whatever. You treat him like your neighbor, because you're supposed to.
Yeah, and maybe you only see him that one time as far as up close and personal for an intense period, but you're always there for them and they're there for you, and that's our editorial for today, Tom. Let's talk a little bit more about the second CD and when it's going to come out and some of the flavors of that. Some of the titles look like things that people have heard before, but can you divide them up enough to talk about the second one, which will come out later this year?
Yeah, so the volume 2 will come out in September 2020, and to me, volume 2 is obviously sort of the centerpiece of that volume 2 is the song "The Flood of 2010" that we just talked about. But volume 2 overall is a little bit darker to me, and maybe also has more spiritual overtones. There's a couple of more gospel tinged songs on that, and that's also, you know, that that's why the whole thing is called To Live in Two Worlds. You know, like, it's To Live in Two Worlds in terms of making a bluegrass record with the band and having one foot in that world and one foot in the world of more like folk music, more the world of Norman Blake, who's a big inspiration to me. And so, you know, stylistically, there's, I have one foot in that world, one foot in the bluegrass world. Volume one is more, there's a lot of historical references on that record, and volume two is more of a spiritual record. So that's To Live in Two Worlds, To Live in Two Worlds, because I was born in Europe and I live here. And so it's all of that. And To Live in Two Worlds also means to me, like, to work in today's world while I'm eternally fascinated with things that happened 100 years ago, 150 years ago. And yeah, so that's.
You absolutely are. And I know you and I have talked about another album where you. Here's what I would do, Tom, and I wouldn't tell you this at the time, but when you would describe, when one of your songs, I would hear a lyric or a reference to something, and sometimes I would research that concept or that idea, and you were always looking at history and always, and it is that Civil War period in that part of the South around that time mm-hmm. period, you're always bringing out new things that, a new perspective. I want to think of the song from the last album that I had from you about, again, it was a Civil War setting, and it had to do with a young woman. I think it's one of the most beautiful songs that I've ever heard. And I can't think of the name of it, Tom. We've talked about this before. What's the song about the young woman who's, I think she may be, she works, is she for sale? Is she what? Explain that. Remember what I'm talking about?
I know. You're talking about a song called Confederate Jazz.
I kept thinking Confederate, and I couldn't think of Jasmine. But yeah, that story to me, I still think it's one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard. And I think just a beautiful melody and a beautiful point that you're making. I'm sorry, I couldn't remember the name of it. Go ahead.
It's a song that I wrote with one of my favorite people in co-writers, a guy called Jefferson Ross, and he had the idea. And there is a plant that's called Confederate Jasmine that grows in his garden in Atlanta. And he had the idea of using that name and writing about a fictional character and calling her Confederate Jasmine. And she's, in our song, she's a prostitute in Savannah, Georgia, during the Civil War. And Sherman has just marched all the way through Georgia to the sea, and he's in Savannah, and he decided not to destroy Savannah. And she's just doing her job, her work, and she contracts some kind of fever from somebody and dies. It's a sad story, but it's just a lot of detail about Savannah. I just always liked the thought of, you know, Confederate Jasmine only blooms for a couple of days and then it's gone, and the Confederacy only lasted for 4 years, thank God, and so it's too fleeting thing, you know, and there's just a poetry to the term Confederate Jasmine.
There is, and it's a beautiful song. And the reason I bring it up is, even though it's in a prior album, is that the second, the volume two, which will come out in September of To Live in Two Worlds, you have that ability still to focus on a moment and make it real in the songs that you write and the way that you sing it. That one to me was like, I'm right there. I understand everything that's going on. There's a woman trying to get by. She's trying to exist in that horrible world. And the songs you talked about, the spiritual and the more gospel things in volume mm-hmm. two, you have a great facility, Tom, to see a moment, to read about a moment. You're not seeing it. To read about a moment and then just enlarge upon it and make it more personal to the listener.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think it's kind of it's the job. I think it's a songwriter's job, if you will. I mean, obviously, the song of a songwriter is just to write things that people like or that you like. But I think it's also, the job description that I have for myself is to look at the world as it presents itself to me today, to look at the world from yesterday, and to you know, somewhat faithfully write about the characters that I find interesting, and to put myself in their shoes and try to see the world the way they saw them, you know, and try to figure out what their motivation was to do what they did. I would find it very claustrophobic to just write about myself. I'd much rather write about other people than about myself. So, but that's just me, you know. It's not saying that other people shouldn't write the way they should write. I'm just basically having an having a good time.
You're having a good time. You keep saying that, Tom. You keep saying you're having a good time, and we are too. Listen, I really do. I can't tell you how happy I am to know you and to be able to. Sometimes you and I have talked about things not related to music. We just talk about stuff sometimes, and I really appreciate your knowledge and your thoughtfulness. And man, it really comes through on your songs. We can maybe talk about Volume 2 as it gets closer to September in a little more detail.
Yeah.
But let's make a plan to do that since I have both of them by virtue of you sending them to me, and we're talking about things people don't have access to, but they're going to want to. So let's, Tom, you pick another tune as we cut out of here that you'd like for the listeners on Unreal Bluegrass to hear.
Yeah.
And I'll put it in.
Since we talked about Tammy Rogers, let's play one that I wrote with Tammy. It's called Calling Me Home. And it's on the first volume of those two, and it's a song that doesn't have a historical. There's no historical references in this song, and it's not a song about being a musician necessarily, but it could be. It's just a song about people who are in a relationship with each other, and they have to be apart a lot, which is true for my wife and I because I play a lot of music, and it's true for Tammy and her husband Jeff. And it's a song about the understanding that you reach that's okay. You don't you give each other the freedom to do those things, and you miss each other, but you also that gives you a place to come home to. You can't come home if you never go away. So that song is Calling Me Home is about the gratitude of having a place to come home to and a great partner, and I have that, and Tammy has that, and so that's what we wrote that day.
Well, Tom Utes, I'm going to say goodbye, let you get back to your busy day of writing songs. And as we leave you and we say goodbye, the listeners will hear the song you just described so well, Calling Me Home. Thanks so much, Tom. I'll catch up to you again. Let's make sure that we circle around and come back for the drop of part two of To Live in Two Worlds.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, Tom. Thank you so much for your always willingness to be part of the show.
Thank you.
All right.